in just a minute, we're going to be working with Hosea and finishing the book. So we're going to be starting with chapter 8 and working our way through. I have a very brief review on the first 7 chapters. So we'll be going into chapter 8 and reading on down through chapter 14. Some of these chapters are particularly short. The message is very clear. In my Bible, for instance, the New American Standard particular edition that I have views the prophets in the form, prints them in the form of poetry, if you will. And so they have sometimes just a few words on a given line, and there's just all kinds of white space here. So we'll have plenty of time tonight. And so I'm going to take a little bit of time at the outset here to deal with what might best be considered current events, I guess. How many of you have been watching the national, you know, or international news in the last about 4 hours? Okay. So for those of you that do not know, and for all of you who I'm so grateful, worried about my personal safety and certainly the safety of Susan Dahl and Emma Vermette. It is true that about 3 or 4 hours ago, maybe 4 hours ago, that Iran from Syria lobbed about 20 missiles into the Golan Heights. That is the first time that Iran has ever directly assaulted what would be considered Israeli territory. So, of course, there's going to be all over the news and all the excitement, you know, everything that goes with all of that. And I thought it might be well then just to take a couple of minutes, help you to understand what's going on there, just as a means of allaying everyone's fears. As I told Susan and Emma not too long ago, bear in mind what I used to teach my driver's ed students when I was teaching driver's ed. And it would come, you know, for their first drive, and they'd be scared to death. And I would say to them, I do not care at all if you get hurt or killed. But I do care if I get hurt or killed. So I want you to understand that nothing's going to happen while I'm in this car because I don't want to get hurt. That's exactly the way we'd have a good laugh. The kids would relax. You know, we'd go for a drive. And that's the way I feel about Israel. I have gone on to the State Department's kind of watch list. They send out notices, you know, for American citizens traveling abroad. So I'm watching this very carefully. But at this point, it doesn't faze me in the slightest. Every attention is still going. You know, I don't think there's anything to be particularly worried about. But if you will, follow the bouncing ball. This is covering the entirety of the city of Tiberias on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. What is happening is that beyond these orange lines, two of which you see are really pretty narrow and parallel right there, this is all Syria over here. The yellow line is actually their border, but the Golan Heights is this larger area right through here, separated by this buffer zone that the UNDOF is managing. And these missiles have come from somewhere in Iran, and they've dropped down into the Golan Heights. The events are all unfolding as we speak, and so we really don't know exactly where they're coming from. Israel is 10 hours ahead of us. So you look at your watch, it's 7 o'clock p.m., and all you have to do is subtract 2 and change it to a.m. or p.m. as you need. So right now it's sunrise, 5 o'clock in the morning, and they'll be getting all their assessments, you know, after the night. Nobody was killed, doesn't appear that anybody was injured, it's only very minor damage, it's only been 20 missiles that I heard about last. They were all going into the Golan Heights, and the reason for that is because nobody wants a war. Really, nobody. But what happened was Iran's been backing Syria, and Iran is the world's largest state terrorist organization. And so they have been bringing all kinds of weaponry into Syria. They're using Syria, trying to build a military presence for the possibility of what one day maybe would be an actual invasion of Israel. Back in 1967, there was a big war. Now, for 8 years, I've been following all of this with intense interest. So I read about this, you know, almost every day. I've read about their war for independence in 1948 several times, numerous times, 67, 73. They've had 8 full-scale wars since 1948, 2 intifadas, and a whole lot of other death deaths, you know, like down in
Gaza Strip. But what this means is that everything along this line right here is really Syrian territory. But in the war of 1967, in amazing military success, the Jews pushed them all back out of there and seized this territory. And you can argue forever before the United Nations on what all that means, but that's what happened. These are the Golan Heights. So it's all high territory that's looking down on Israel. Militarily, it is crucially important that you control the high ground. So Israel seized that in an outright war in 67. They've held it ever since. And then the United Nations has gotten involved, and they've established this buffer zone that's between these orange lines that you see right here, between the Golan Heights, which is disputed territory controlled by Israel, and then no man's land, and then, you know, the Syrian countryside there. So, you know, this is where the house is that Susan and Emma and I and four other of my friends are going to be staying in for a week. I'll be leaving on Monday. And what that means is that from that location right there, I really wish I'd been there last night. Yes, from the house to the furthest part of the Golan Heights area, which is right there, is only 46 miles. And from the house, and that's the furthest point right there, from the house to Damascus, which is right here, is 70 miles. And then, as I guess I overlooked at the top, it's only 7 miles across here. So from 7 miles to 46 miles to the actual capital is not a lot of miles. Obviously, that is a really, 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 really small area. So the UNDOF is the United Nations Disengagement Observer Force. They are the ones that are all in there with their, you know, scanning equipment to keep an eye on everybody right there. And so I had hoped to go right up here on the border between Lebanon and actual Syria to get up on Mount Hermon so I could get the highest point in the country and look down. It's looking pretty dubious that I'll be able to do that now. That would be the only thing at this point that I would change. Is that we'll see how it develops over the next few days. But probably I'll not be going up to get, you know, where I can step this way into Syria and that way into Lebanon. So just bear in mind that this is extremely small scale, and it's payback that everybody understands and expects. Israel's been watching the movements. They didn't like what they were seeing. And some weeks ago, they made an incursion into Syria, and they blew up some facilities there that, for the first time, killed some Iranian soldiers. Iran has a reputation in the world like everybody else. They've got to do something about that. So Israel knew it was coming. Everybody knew it was coming. This is just sparklers is all it is. So please, everybody relax. If it gets bad, we'll not go. That's why I bought the trip insurance. I get all my money back. Okay. But at this point, the media needs for it to be a big deal, and it's totally not. It's all expected, it's all understood, and, you know, I really don't expect it to escalate very far at all. But if I'd been there last night, I would have been able to hear those missiles going off, and I really wish I could. I don't think Iran has any intention of trying to cross these lines into Israel. If they do that, they know the whole wide world, not to mention our president, is going to be exceptionally unhappy. I think they're plenty bright enough to understand self-preservation, and so they're not likely to do anything like that. So watch with great interest, and do the best you can, brethren, to see that nothing has changed for 3,000 years. It's just that now they can hurl, you know, firecrackers across each other's borders, and before you had to go in on a horseback or chariot. So thank you so much for all your concern. I know it's very worrisome for everybody. I really don't think it's a big deal. But it is interesting to watch, and we're, you know, have an unfolding thing going on. Does anybody have any questions about any of that? Okay. I enjoy these, if you will, not in a, you know, untoward way. because it is so biblical. It is just so much like the way it's always been. And now that I've been there three times, going to my fourth time, they start naming these places, you know, and all of the cities and the times and the Arameans of old and all of that becomes just a very living to me, very precious events that I can help me understand the scriptures themselves. So let's go back and have a brief review of Hosea, in which essentially this exact same thing was happening. Syria sounds like what biblical country? Assyria, because it is the same country. And so Hosea is dealing with the Assyrians. Hosea is talking about the destruction of the 10 northern tribes, which is the area you were just looking at, northern Israel. And these invasions that were going to be coming in from that very same region were God's judgments. God is still in control. God's will is going to be done. We just stand by to watch how it will be done and then try to decipher his purposes. So what we saw in the first seven chapters is a very unusual thing, though it's been done by not just Hosea, but other prophets as well, in which God looks at the circumstances, and in this case, he selects harlotry as the theme of the first seven chapters. And it just comes up again and again, and it gets more than 20 times, or about 20 times, I think the word is used. That is the theme of the first half of the book. The people are guilty of harlotry. And since the people are guilty of harlotry, Hosea is chosen to suffer as a living example. He's kind of an embodied prophecy, if you will. So he is told to take a wife of harlotry. We work through all of that. The harlotry that is mentioned in the book 20 times, all these first seven chapters, is it, how do I say this, of the 20 times, what percentage is not talking about sexual activity? Well, it could be 100%, but it's at least 90-some-odd%. The harlotry that's being described there, as we saw in the first seven chapters, is actually a term, a theme that's being used to represent what? A kind of unfaithfulness that you call idolatry. So, he suffered. He took a wife of harlotry, I think of idolatry, and had to live the unhappiness that God was experiencing, much more of which we'll be seeing this evening. But in these first seven chapters, we also saw repeatedly that after the punishment that God says is inevitable, and all prophecies came true, both Jew and Gentile, so remember I was pointing out repeatedly, it's not just the 10 northern tribes, but Judah's worked in there fairly regularly. And then we have prophecies quoted in the New Testament, Romans 9:25, for instance, where they are interpreted by the New Testament writers as speaking of the Gentiles, will be God's people. Twice we have a statement that's quoted in Romans 9, verses 25 and 26, that they who are not my people will be called my people. So the first seven chapters, it is God's terrible wrath at the people's unfaithfulness. It is also a very prominent theme that he loves these people. He is calling them to repentance. And ultimately, whatever happens to the people in that generation and in, you know, the near-term future in the physical land, God is going to replace all of these problems with a new covenant, a new king, and far better days, which are, of course, Christianity, Jew and Gentile, will be God's people. So we saw all of that. These prophecies are directed to Israel and Judah throughout the whole book. So we've seen it in half. But will include the Gentiles as well. So now, let's just start reading. We're going to look at chapter 8 tonight. It's really easy. Each time we're just going to read the chapter, and then we'll go back and make some brief observations. So chapter 8, put the trumpet to your lips. Like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of Yahweh, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. They cry out to me, my God, We of Israel know you. Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. They've set up kings, but not by me. They've appointed princes, but I did not know it. With their silver and gold, they've made idols for themselves that they might be cut off. He has rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For from Israel is even this. A craftsman made it, so it is not God. Surely the calf of Samaria will be broken to pieces. For they sow a wind, and they reap the whirlwind. The standing grain is no heads, it yields no grain. Should it yield, strangers would swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. They are now among the nations like a vessel in which no one delights. For they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey all alone. Ephraim has hired lovers, even though they hire allies among the nations. Now I will gather them up, and they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. Since Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin, they have become altars of sinning for him. Though I wrote for him 10,000 precepts of my law, they are regarded as a strange thing. As for my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and eat it. But the Lord has taken no delight in them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish them for their sins. They will return to Egypt. For Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces, and Judah has multiplied fortified cities, but I will send a fire on its cities that it may consume its palatial dwellings. End of chapter 8. Now, it's very much like what we've already seen. Just these observations at first, and a couple of things I'd like to note in the text itself. In this chapter, there's not one word of hope. Now, earlier, we've seen quite a bit where God is pleading with the people to repent. He is offering them freedom from these things, not in chapter 8. By the time you've turned past the first half, God's really had it, and he's telling them so. And Egypt continues to appear in the book. Since, I think it's chapter 2, and now I've got to go look back. Since chapter 2, Egypt keeps popping up. Egypt appears in chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 8, 9, 11, 12, and 13. Keeps coming up again and again and again. But every time you read it, bear in mind, he is not talking about physical Egypt, even when he says they're going back to Egypt. Egypt is being used as a figure of their downfall and doom, because in the history of Israel, what is the one nation as an enemy that is most prominent? It's Egypt in their history. What nation had conquered them and enslaved them the longest? Well, Egypt by several centuries. So Egypt keeps being used. But Brennan, you know, it's like, suppose I came in here tonight and I said, oh boy, here we go again. Look what's going on in Israel and Syria. You know, we're going right back to 1948. Now, does anybody think I have a time machine? No. If I say, the way this thing is developing, we're all going to go right back to Vietnam. Do you know what I mean when I say that? And Vietnam isn't involved at all, is it, in what's happening today in Israel? So Egypt is being used in precisely the same manner. Now, one thing I did want to just make a mention of, twice the word calf is used. It's used in 5, and I can't remember what the other one is here, and I'm not, 5 and 6 both, I guess it is. Or no, it's... Well, see, here I go. I can't do it with my eyes. You look for it. Is it 5 and 6? Yeah, it is. 5 and 6. So this calf is going to be ground up. What calf are we talking about? How many calves are we talking about? We're really talking about 2 calves. Who set up these 2 golden calves?
Jeroboam the first, in what year? Or at least immediately after, what year? 930 B.C. When who died? When Solomon died, Rehoboam became king, and it didn't take long at all, and we're in full-scale revolt. So, in chapter 8, this calf that's being talked about is apparently, and perhaps the very calf, that they've been having problems with for a couple hundred years now, because of what Jeroboam set up. One in the north, one in the south, to keep the people contained so they would not go to Jerusalem. Now, the next thing, interesting figure in verse 9, a wild donkey all alone, you know, they go to Assyria. They've been trying to make alliances with Assyria. And it's just trying to point out how foolish and empty and pointless and powerless and wandering that is. You go over and look to Assyria for help, instead of your God, you're acting like a donkey wandering around all alone out in the wilderness. You know, not really the best of accolades, you know, for somebody. Now, I will freely confess, I don't understand the last phrase in verse 10. So I'll leave it to you. There's several ways to understand it. The people of the time knew. Seems to escape us now. Even though they hire among the nations, so allies is supplied, and I think that's the idea. You know, they went to Assyria in the preceding verse. Now I will gather them up, and they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. So who's the king of princes, and what is his burden? Is it somebody, you know, at the time? Is it Jesus the Christ? Is it, you know, God? Who's the king of princes? Well, any of these are possibilities. I don't know. They, you know, got the point. They're going to diminish. And so I wish I could help you with that one. That one we just really don't know about. And then, as you look at verse 12, are there 10,000 laws in the Old Testament? No. Those account put it somewhere around 600, something like that. So bear in mind, brethren, that in the Old Testament, it'll help you in your understanding of the New Testament, particularly in the book of Revelation. Does every number need to be taken literally? No. The rule is taken literally unless you have some compelling evidence that it shouldn't be understood in a very literal sense. You need some compelling evidence, and in this case, there's plenty. We have the entire old law and calculators, you know, so we can figure out how many laws there are, and it's not 10,000. So 10,000 is being used as a representation of what? All of God's law. So I wrote from 10,000 precepts of my law. But for a minute, let's just stop. Could there have been 10,000 times that some prophet over the course of hundreds of years has revealed things to these people that God did not see fit to record in the 39 books of the Old Testament? Well, sure. And so, you know, it could actually be literal. But it doesn't matter.
But in my translation says the great things of the law.
In verse 12, I wrote him great things of my law. Okay. I don't know why. Apparently there's a Hebrew translation or textual, you know, comparison there. I have no notes on it in my Bible, you know, and so I don't know what to tell you. But still, it gets to the same thing. Did God go the extra mile for these people? Did he give them advantages that nobody else had? Isn't it just a crying shame that they're not responding to him? Yes, it is.
Couldn't
it have been sarcastic? Sandra, I'm sorry, I forgot my hearing aid.
Couldn't the remark be sarcastic? I've given them 10,000 things, and that's still not enough.
That is possible. In the Scriptures, Old and New Testament, do use sarcasm, and quite a few times. So it directly answers your question. Yeah, it could be sarcasm. Bill?
With reference to the phrase king of princes,
mm-hmm.
it has a connection to Isaiah 10, verse 8.
Okay, you've got a note in your particular Bible for Isaiah 10, 8.
Yeah.
All right, let me run back there then and see what it is. Yeah, okay, and that's all the verse says.
are not my princes all kings, but it's words that are put in the mouth of the Assyrians. And that's actually, brother, you might want to jot that down. That is helpful. In Isaiah 10:8, you have a similar expression. Isaiah 10:8. Okay, so I'll leave you to sort that out. You know what the burden is still. I really just don't know. Okay, so let's move on then to chapter 9. All right, in chapter 9, do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultation like the nations, for you have played the harlot, forsaking your God. Now that is the last use of harlot in the book. You didn't see it in chapter 8. It's not in chapter 7. It's sprinkled all over 4 and 5. So these some 20 times that it's used are all in the front part of the book. That this will be the last time that that word and a direct reference to it actually appears. They have played the harlot. They've been idolaters, forsaking your God. You've loved harlot's earnings on every threshing floor. Threshing floor and wine press will not feed them, and the new wine will fail them. They will not remain in the Lord's hand, but Ephraim will return to where? Egypt. But where are they going to be eating? See, so you have the key. It's explained for you here. Assyria is what he's talking about when he uses the expression Egypt. But Egypt has all those overtones and ideas that they'll remember from their history. So it is used as a blanket figure to represent all of this. But specifically, they'll be eating unclean food in Assyria. Any of the Assyrians taking them slaves going to care about what they think is clean or unclean for the Jews? I don't care. They will not pour out libations of wine to Yahweh. See, not in Assyria. Their sacrifices will not please him. Their bread will be like mourner's bread. All who eat of it will be defiled, for their bread will be for themselves. It will not enter the house of the Lord. So if you've been trained to think of a thing as particularly revolting and disgusting, and then it's the only thing you can eat, it's tough. And so when they get to Assyria, it's eat or die. And what they're going to have to eat is what Assyrians provide. It's got nothing to do with cleanliness according to Moses' law. So it couldn't be used as a sacrifice, and they're going to feel, you know, horrible because of it. Verse 5, what will you do on the day of the appointed festival and on the day of the feast of the Lord? Behold, they will go because of destruction. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Now Memphis is a chief city in Egypt. Weeds will take over their treasures of silver. Thorns will be in their tents. But by now we get what Egypt represents. Memphis, same thing. The days of punishment, verse 7, have come. That's why Egypt is quoted. The days of retribution have come. Let Israel know this. The prophet is a fool. So is that talking about himself? No. But what is the problem with Israel? Do they lack prophets who claim to be prophets but aren't, and tell them what they want to hear? Those are the prophets that he's talking about. They're false prophets and they're fools. The inspired man is demented. You guys claim that you have inspiration from me, but these guys are nutcases. Because of the grossness of your iniquity and because your hostility is so great, Ephraim was a watchman with my God, a prophet. So now he's saying the whole country, we're my spokespeople. We have that close a relationship. Like you were all of you my prophet. Yet the snare of a birdcatcher is in all his ways. There's only hostility in the house of his God. They've gone deep in depravity as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree in its first season. Now, brethren, you know, you're coming out of the winter. Remember, you're on foot. It's an agrarian economy, you know, and you start getting the spring sunshine and all that, you know, and then you get your first fruit. You're walking around in the woods, you know, and there's those grapes and there's that date fig and all that. What do? You just run over and grab it. Winter's over, you know, the good times are here again. So he says, oh, that's the way you were to me, that pure delight. You know, and just after long dearth, now we have the plenty again, and that's the way I look at you. But they came to Baal Peor and devoted themselves to shame. You can read about that in the Old Testament. They became as detestable as that which they loved. As for Ephraim, their glory will fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, and no conception. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them until not a man is left. Yes, woe to them indeed when I depart from them. Ephraim, as I have seen, is planted in a pleasant meadow like Tyre. But Ephraim will bring out his children for slaughter. Give them, O Lord. What will you give them? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breasts. All their evil is at Gilgal. Indeed, I came to hate them there. Because of the wickedness of their deeds, I'll drive them out of my house. I will love them no more. All our princes are rebels. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They will bear no fruit. Even though they bear children, I will slay the precious ones of their womb. My God will cast them away because they have not listened to him, and they will be wanderers among the nations. Now, brethren, you might have noticed here at the very end there in verse 17, we saw this a moment ago earlier, suddenly it kind of got personal for Hosea, didn't it? As you read through the prophecy, mostly you can tell that what he says are the direct words of God. But then when he says, my God will cast them away, and because they've not listened to him, see, that went first person in Hosea, didn't it? Now, I still think he's inspired. I still think what he's writing, God wants him to write, but his own emotions now, God is bringing to the fore and spilling out on the page. So, despite the fact that this is the last use of the word harlot, they are idolaters, and Assyria is identified as their Egypt in chapter 9 in verse 3. There's nothing they can do to stop it, and there's not one word of hope in this chapter either. They will be destroyed. That's all there is to it. Now, that expression that you saw in verse 9, Gibeah. Do you want to take just a minute and talk about that? You will also notice we're going to have Beth Arbel and Beth Aven. We're going to have Bethel. We've got Gilgal in this chapter. There's all these different cities that are being named. I'm not taking the time to go and deal, you know, with each one of those. Just take note that especially with Gilgal and Bethel, in those two cities, God had been especially good to them. There were very significant historical events that you can read about back in the Old Testament. So God is particularly unhappy when in these cities of all places, these people would misbehave like this. Same would be true of Gibeah. But in verse 9, it's as in the days of Gibeah, he'll remember their iniquity. They have gone, it says at the start of verse 9, in deep depravity as what? In the days of Gibeah. So, what happened in the days of Gibeah? Please write in your margin, Judges, and it's the last three chapters, 19, 20, and 21 of Judges. The book of Judges ends with three chapters about Gibeah. It ends with Gibeah being so depraved that when the traveling Levite came through with his concubine, and they wanted, just like in Sodom and Gomorrah in the city, to seize him for homosexual rape, it fell, that terrible abuse, on his concubine. And that night, the city men raped, abused her to such an extent that she died after she was only able to crawl back to the guy's house, and with her hand on the doorstep, there she died, and there he found her in the morning. It's just an unbelievable story. The guy is outraged. Nothing's been done like this in Israel. So he got out his knife, and what did he do? He cut her into 12 parts. And then it says he sent her into all of Israel, but apparently with 12 parts, what did he do? He sent one part of her body to every part of Israel. And it upset Israel. The entire nation back in Judges, all 12 tribes got mad at a city that I only saw for the first time on my last trip. So I took these photographs from a place called Nabi Samwil. Nabi Samwil is a Hebrew way of saying that they think this is where the prophet Samuel was buried. Now, we have no way of knowing for sure, but I'm standing on a hill right here taking a picture of this area that is just, I think I've got it, no, I'll get it in a minute. Well, there it is. This is Gibeah right here, this conical hill. It's exactly 6 miles north and northeast of Jerusalem. So it's in the territory of the Benjamites. This city was built up in those days on this little hill right here. See how it stands out in the midst of that valley. So standing on the higher hill of Nabi Samwil, you know, I took these pictures as the guy that I'll be with this time was describing many events that have taken place through the years on that hill of Gibeah. It's exactly 1 mile away as you look at that picture. You can see it's a very easy walk. I get there in 10 minutes or less. And here you've got this city of terraces to this day. So as I zoomed in, see how many terraces there are going up onto that hill. And as a matter of fact, the walls from 1050 B.C., about when they sunk into that depravity that takes 3 chapters to tell you about at the end of Judges, in about 1050 B.C., the guide said, Luke Chandler, that the walls you could still find. If you're an archaeologist today, you'd be able to pick it out. Now, I can't tell you which of these rows of rocks, you know, would be going back that far, but this is that city where those events took place. And truly, that was the bottom in just virtually all of Israel's history, what took place there in that city. And as a result, all of Israel was so angry that 85,100 people are going to die as a result of it, and they're not all Gibeahites. The first big numbers, 40,000, half of the people that died, were the 400,000 man strong army that came down because these guys would not repent. These guys were outnumbered hugely, and yet God had a message he wanted to send to everybody. So the first people to get killed, 40,000 in the first two battles, are all on the side of the good guys who come in to, you know, avenge this horrible crime that took place. So see, brethren, when you go back and read 3 chapters, you're familiar with the story. Read them tonight, 19, 20, and 21. All you have to do to a Jew is say, like the depravity in Gibeah. Like the depravity in Gibeah is only 5 words. But when you say that, what does it call to mind? It's just horror. And he says, you're that bad now. That's what I think of you now. The way you people behave. God is not pleased. So, chapter 10. Israel is a luxuriant vine. He produces fruit for himself. The more his fruit, the more altars he made. The richer his land, the better he made the sacred pillars. Both idols. Their heart is faithless. Now they must bear their guilt. Yahweh will break down their altars and destroy their sacred pillars. Surely now they'll say, we have no king, for we do not revere the Lord. As for the king, what can he do for us? Now, this is a little bit hard to understand. You know, the best that I can get, I think, is that, again, God is kind of putting their own words in their mouth or representing what they might say. You know, but what it is they're going to be disaffected. They'll admit they don't respect God, but their kings are not helping them either. It's a part of the punishment. And so in 4, they speak words with worthless oaths. They make covenants. And judgment sprouts like poisonous weeds in the furrows of the field. The inhabitants of Samaria will fear for the calf of Beth-Aven. Now, we just have that calf. Where was the calf? In the south of the 10 tribes, just a little bit north of Jerusalem. But where was that calf? What city? Bethel. 12 miles north of Jerusalem, Bethel. Okay? Beth means house. El means God. Bethel was house of God. But what did Jeroboam put there? The calf. So God is now referring to this city as Beth-Aven. Beth still means house. What does Aven mean? Vanity. So write it down, brethren, because that house of vanity occurs several times. We already saw it last week. So Beth-Aven is house of vanity, but it's the nickname for Bethel, where the calf was that's going to be ground to dust and taken off to Assyria. So Beth-Aven is not a different city. It's just a different name for the same source of their idolatry going all the way back to Jeroboam the First. Indeed, its people will mourn for it. Its idolatrous priests will cry out over it, over its glory, since it has departed from it. The thing itself will be carried to Assyria as tribute to King Yerub, is how you would pronounce it. Ephraim will be seized with shame. Israel will be ashamed of its own counsel. Samaria will be cut off with her king like a stick on the surface of the water. Also, the high places of Aven. What does Aven mean? Vanity. The high places of vanity. Now, you hear this expression in numerous books in the Old Testament. They were worshiping on every high hill. What does that mean? They had their shrines to their false gods up on every high hill. So the high places of vanity, the sin of Israel will be destroyed. Thorn and thistle will grow on their altars. Then they'll say to the mountains, cover us, and to the hills, fall on us. From the days of Gibeah you've sinned, O Israel. There they stand. Will not the battle against the sons of iniquity overtake them in Gibeah? How many died in Gibeah? 85,000 plus. What's coming for them? They know all too well. And don't care, because they become as corrupt, as depraved as those people were in 1050 B.C. or thereabouts. 10. When it is my desire, I'll chastise them, and the peoples will be gathered against them, where they are bound for their double guilt. And Ephraim is a trained heifer that loves to thresh. Why would a heifer, a young, cow, love to thresh? Isn't that work? Don't you have to wear a yoke? You get to eat. Deuteronomy 25, you shall not muzzle the ox. We've had occasion to talk about that just last week. Okay, so there's the reference. Sure, they get to eat all day long if they want. So they'd love to do that. But he says, I'll come over her fair neck with a yoke and harness Ephraim. Judah will plow, Jacob will harrow for himself. And then comes verse 12. Now, this is one of those verses you might want to copy down, put on your refrigerator. So, with a view to righteousness, reap in accordance with kindness. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord until He comes to rain righteousness on you. As a matter of fact, about 40 years ago, I used that verse for maybe the second or third sermon I ever preached. I just seized on that out of Hosea and taught, that you want to break up your fallow ground. What is fallow ground? It's just lying there doing nothing. Fallow ground would be in a year of Jubilee or in a rotation of crops today where you don't sow in that year. Well, break it up and start sowing. So what? Righteousness. And what will you reap in accordance with kindness? And what will God do at the end of verse 12? He'll rain righteousness on you. Hunger and thirst after it, brethren. 13, you have plowed wickedness, you've reaped injustice, you've eaten the fruit of lies, because you have trusted in your way, in your numerous warriors. Therefore a tumult will arise among your people. And all your fortresses will be destroyed as Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle, when mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Thus it will be done to you at Bethel because of your great wickedness. At dawn, the king of Israel will be completely cut off. That doesn't mean dawn the next day. Usually dawn is the idea that you think everything's going to go well, it's a brand new day, you know, here we go. The idea is, before you can get anything done, suddenly, you know, in that day, everything's over. Okay, so in chapter 10, is there any word of hope? No, but there is that one verse. There's this heartbreaking appeal. You know, break up your fallow ground. Sow righteousness. So there's that one verse that's just not entirely dark. And now chapter 11. When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Now please note that's quoted about Jesus in Matthew 2 and verse 15. Matthew 2, 15. I'm not going to deal with all of that today, but I just think Matthew is led by the Spirit, you know, to make a comparison where this is not a direct prophecy of Jesus, but the nature of prophecies and how they're used is to be deep study for us tonight. But that is the source, this verse of Matthew 2:15. Verse 2. The more they called them, the more they went from them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Yet it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of a man, with bonds of love, and I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their jaws, and I bent down and fed them. For they will return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria, he will be their king, because they refuse to return. And the sword will whirl against their cities, and will demolish their gate bars, and consume them because of their counsel. So my people are bent on turning from me, though they call them to the one on high, none exalts him. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I surrender you, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboiim? Now, brethren, Admah and Zeboiim are two cities who were destroyed at the same time two other cities were destroyed, that are the two most famously destroyed cities in the whole Bible. Okay, all four of those cities were destroyed simultaneously. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboiim. So he says, how can I make you like that? You know, you can feel the passion in my voice. God is just so unhappy with these people. I treat you like a little child. I love you so, and now I've got to do this to you. My heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are kindled. Verse 9, I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim again, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. They will walk after Yahweh. He will roar like a lion, indeed he will roar, and his sons will come trembling from the west. They'll come trembling like birds from Egypt, like doves from the land of Assyria. That's the third time Assyria is in the same verse with Egypt, so you know he's talking about Assyria, using Egypt as a figure. And I'll settle them in their houses, declares Yahweh. Ephraim surrounds me with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit. Judah is also unruly against God, even against the Holy One who's faithful. Now, brethren, in chapter 11, we turn a corner in this book. I'm going to take the next two chapters together because they're the same thing. At this point, it's as if God's heart just breaks and he just gushes like a child over, a parent over a child that you can't save. He loves his lost children, and it's just killing him. Chapter 12. Ephraim feeds on wind and pursues the east wind, continually multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. You know, getting alliances. The Lord also has a dispute with Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. He'll repay him according to his deeds. In the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his maturity he contended with God, yet he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him where? At Bethel. But whose history are we now telling? All the way back to Jacob and Esau. The very establishment of the 12 tribes of Jacob, or Israel. So he's rehearsing the old history, the very beginning of this nation, when he remembers them like a child that he was just raising up. It's breaking his heart. In verse 5, even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. Therefore, return to your God, observe kindness and justice, and wait for your God continually. A merchant in whose hands are false balances. He loves to oppress. We're back to Ephraim's sins. And Ephraim said, surely I've become rich. I found wealth for myself. All my labors they'll find me. No iniquity which would be sin. But I have been Yahweh your God since the land of Egypt. I will make you live in tents again, as in the days of the appointed festival. I've also spoken to the prophets, and I gave numerous visions. And through the prophets I gave parables. Is there iniquity in Gilead? Shouldn't be. Surely there was. In Gilgal, they sacrificed bulls. Yes, their altars are like the stone heaps beside the furrows of the field. Again, idolatrous shrines. Now, Jacob fled to the land of Aram. What land is that? Today? Syria. He went up, probably through Damascus, which was occupied at that time. He may very likely have gone through the Golan Heights, crossed the UNDOF, and on around to the capital city of Damascus. Where am I? Aram, verse 12, and Israel worked for a wife, and for a wife he kept sheep. But by a prophet the Lord brought Israel from Egypt, and by a prophet he was kept. Ephraim has provoked a bitter anger, so his Lord will leave his blood guilt on him and bring back his reproach to him. God's lamentation continues, but it's in the form of telling history from the beginning, which should call to mind how much he's loved them throughout all those years. Which brings us to chapter 13. When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling. He exalted himself in Israel. But through Baal, he did wrong and died. And now they sin more and more, and make for themselves molten images, idols, skillfully made from their silver, all of them the work of craftsmen. They say of them, let the men who sacrifice kiss the calves. Therefore, they'll be like the morning cloud, like the dew which soon disappears, like chaff which is blown away from the threshing floor, and like smoke from a chimney. Yet I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt, and you are not to know any God except me. For there is no Savior besides me. I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. As they had their pasture, they became satisfied. Being satisfied, their heart became proud. Therefore, they forgot me. So I'll be like a lion to them, like a leopard I'll lie in wait by the wayside. I'll encounter them like a bear robbed of her cubs, and I'll tear open their chests. There I'll also devour them like a lioness, as a wild beast would tear them. It is your destruction, O Israel, that you're against me, against your help. Where now is your king, that he may save you and all your cities, your judges of whom you requested? Give me a king and princes. When did that happen? Saul. Get to the end of Judges, and right about the time of Gibeah, what are all the people wanting? Oh, give us a king so we can be like everybody else. See how that, well, that turned out. Verse 11. I gave you a king in my anger. Took him away in my wrath. Twice I've been to the city, the walls of which they hung his body on. You'll remember, Saul. And in 12, the iniquity of Ephraim is bound up. His sin is stored up. The pains of childbirth come upon him. He's not a wise son. It's not the time. And he should delay at the opening of the womb. Shall I ransom them from the power of Sheol? Shall I redeem them from death? O death, where are your thorns? O Sheol, where is your sting? Compassion will be hidden from my sight. Now again, brethren, the complexities of prophecy and how they use the New Testament, this is interesting, but I'm not going to deal with it. I had no intention, it's not just because my time's about up. But that, of course, is quoted in 1 Corinthians 15:55. 13th chapter ends with verses 15 and 16. Though he flourishes among the reeds, an east wind will come, the wind of Yahweh coming up from the wilderness, and his fountain will become dry, his spring will be dried up, it will plunder his treasury of every precious article. Samaria will be held guilty, for she has rebelled against her God. They will fall by the sword, their little ones will be dashed in pieces, their pregnant women will be ripped open, and brethren, none of that is figurative. is what Assyria was known to do, and we have other records to that effect. That is as literal gets. There are three chapters of God's heart just breaking over these people. Try to go home tonight or tomorrow if you have time. Read those three chapters aloud. Try to pour your own heart into it. Get to know Hosea, as I suggested on Sunday night. Imagine what's going on in his mind as he is reading all of this passion of God's lamentation in chapters 11, 12, and 13. It is all God's just weeping over these people, but he has no choice. Justice demands that there be punishment, and justice will be done. It's the only way to save them, and it's the only way to exonerate God. He cannot tolerate evil. So, we have a tiny little chapter left, chapter 14, and just time enough to read it. It is a bit different. Return, O Israel, to Yahweh your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to Yahweh. Say to him, take away all our iniquity and receive us graciously, that we may present the fruit of our lips, see, worship. Assyria will not save us. We'll not ride on horses. That means we won't trust in our military power. Nor will we say again, our God, to the work of our hands, for in you the orphan finds mercy. I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from them. I'll be like the dew to Israel. He will blossom like the lily. He'll take root like the cedars of Lebanon. His shoots will sprout, and his beauty will be like the olive tree, and his fragrance like Lebanon. Those who live in his shadow will again raise grain. They'll blossom like the vine. His renown will be like the wine of Lebanon. Oh, Ephraim, what more have I to do with the idols? It is I who answer and look after you. I am like a luxurious cypress. From me comes your fruit. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of Yahweh are right, and the righteous will walk in them. But transgressors will stumble in them. This moment, as Hosea is writing those last verses, I guess he just must be pouring his eyes out on that parchment. It had to be just awful. Because, brother, I'm convinced he was not only a living example of God's unhappiness in having to deal with his wife of harlotry, his apostate, unfaithful wife. Hosea had to do that. But brethren, he's inspired. His mind is filled with God's emotions, with God's passion and love. And that last chapter is just spilling your heart on the table. Come home, my wayward child. There's an awful lot of unhappiness in here, brethren. But what is that last chapter all about? The love, the undying love. The ineffable love of a parent for what? For a child that I have loved since Jacob. And I've told you this. Okay? Thanks for your time.